everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. During this segment, we're going to look at inside events in Venezuela and the U.S. efforts for regime change. My guest from Toronto in the first part of our program is Dr. Maria Victor. She is a sociologist who sits on the Board of Governors for the Law Commission of Ontario at York University, which is an independent organization that researches and advocates law and reforms for Ontario citizens. She is the chair of the Canadian, Latin American, and Caribbean Policy Center. She's had 20 years' experience in national and international energy policy analysis and environmental health assessment. She served as a policy advisor and consultant for the Ontario and Canadian governments and taught the sociology of medicine at the University of Toronto. She was born in Venezuela. She was educated in Caracas, New York, and Mexico City. She received her master's from the University of Kent in the United Kingdom and her doctorate in sociology at York University in Toronto. She's been a longtime active member of Canada's Latin American community and an observer and commentator on events unfolding in Venezuela since Hugo Chavez came to office, as well as a sharp critic of U.S. policies towards that nation. She's the author of Give Me Liberty or Death, a very important book. And she writes for Counterpunch. Nice to have you with us today, Maria.
Thank you very much, Gary, for having me on your program. Greatly appreciated.
Maria, in the last couple of days, there have been hearings where the former acting director of the Justice Department, the interim head of that department, as well as the former top overall spy master in the United States, Clapper, both testified about how bad it was that Russia impacted our elections. And they were absolutely certain, with information that they could not share and evidence that they could not show, that without Russian interference, there would have been a different outcome. Hillary Clinton would have been elected. But what really stuck out was how many of the different legislators, both Republican and Democrat, condemned the idea that anyone, any government, would involve itself in trying to alter the outcome of an American election. Now, I'm sitting there watching this all afternoon, thinking, you're kidding. Is this some kind of perverse joke that was recently published in Mad Magazine? We have interfered in more democratic elections than any other country in the world. And I do not have time today, and I don't want to take time away from you to go through that. I will in an upcoming program. It's over 69 different governments that did not align with the United States. These were progressive governments. These were populist governments. These were reform governments for the people. They were all undermined by America and the CIA. The very agency sitting there wagging their finger should have been wagging their finger in a mirror at themselves. So that said, ever since Hugo Chavez was elected as president of Venezuela in 1999 and again in 2007 and until his death in 2013, the United States government and American mainstream media has demonized him for his socialist and revolutionary policies founded upon Latin America's revolutionary leader against the Spanish Empire, Simón Bolívar, and his nationalization of Venezuela's resources, including oil and widespread socialist reforms. Now, before his coming to office, Venezuela was basically the basket case nation of Latin America with widespread poverty and corruption. And during his administration, the Chavez Revolution won support among many progressive Latin American politicians and presidents who wanted to break the U.S.'s stranglehold on their economies. And for that reason, among others, Chavez was a pariah against the Washington consensus, which continues under his successor, Nicolas Maduro, of the National Socialist Party of Venezuela. And we may recall that a couple of years ago, a plot paid for in the United States dollars to assassinate Maduro and set up a de facto government was thwarted. Then shortly after, that same old tactic we hear in Washington repeatedly accused the Venezuela government of possessing weapons of mass destruction. And Americans rarely ever hear about any of this now. Now, at this moment, there is a civil war breaking out in Venezuela. There is horrible violence and civil rights abuses underway, and even rapid poverty and starvation. And the opposition is fully supported by the Trump administration, as it was by the Obama administration and the Bush administration before that, and notably by Hillary Clinton, the super war hawk, the super neocon, when she was Secretary of State under Obama. But before we look at events on the ground at this moment, please provide us a summary of the life in Venezuela under Chavez and Maduro before American infiltration in Venezuela oppositional politics. And what were the socialist reforms and their results that turned Venezuela into a nation other countries such as Bolivia, Ecuador, Brazil, and others emulated? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Thank you very much. Well, that was a very good summary. Venezuela, as a Colombian journalist wrote, is an odd country because it's a country where the poor are happy and the rich are the ones that protest. And this is exactly what's been happening. Since Hugo Chavez was elected in 1999, and the elections in Venezuela, I think there have been 23 in 18 years, and ex-President Jimmy Carter has said that the Venezuelan election process is the best in the world because it has three ways of verifying your vote, through your thumbprint, electronically, and by paper. So Venezuela is a whiz at elections since 1999. Well, since then, the elite that used to run the country for 40 years has conspired to delegitimize the government and to depose him, and they've done the same thing with President Maduro. They thought it would be easier to overthrow President Maduro than President Hugo Chavez, because Hugo Chavez was bigger than life. He was charismatic. He was a unique individual. Well, it hasn't turned out that way. Apart from Cuba, no other Latin American country has had the full force of the spectrum of fourth-generation war of the CIA, which includes terrorism, media manipulation, low-intensity conflict, and psychological warfare. All of this, and the kitchen sink has been thrown at Maduro's government. The economic war that the elites and the corporations have unleashed on the country has been brutal. Whole-scale warehousing of goods, corporate smuggling by the millions, black market manipulations. They have pressured international banks and rating agencies against the country. It, again, a very strange country, Venezuela. It pays its international debts on time, and the next day the rating agencies up the ante and say that it's a risk country. The artificial scarcity of goods, the sabotaging of the electric and water systems, and of course the paramilitary assassinations, the paramilitaries that come from Colombia, and the street violence. All of this has been unleashed on Venezuela by the opposition parties led by the wealthy elite and in cahoots with the corporations and the State Department. Now, despite this economic war, there is no hunger in Venezuela, as defined by international standards. On a world scale, after being one of the best performers during the first decade of this century, Venezuela has slipped a bit, but it's still quite high up. The communal councils and the communes are the ones that have saved the day. They have been feeding the people. Vegetables, fruits, chicken, beef, fish, all have been promoted and helped and distributed in small markets and communal gardens. I've just come back from Venezuela. I went into towns and cities, and there were these street markets and communal markets everywhere, people selling foodstuffs. And, of course, the imported goods are scarce, and, of course, the prices are high in many of them, but in a land with plentiful sun and rain and soil and a huge coastline, there's no threat of hunger or famine, as the opposition media would suggest. And the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the United Nations, has confirmed this. Now, it all came to head the month of April, this past month of April. The stage was set to finally make Venezuela a pariah country through the services of Luis Almagro, the head of the OAS. Now, what they wanted, what the objective was, to declare the country out of democratic bounds. Why? Because this would prepare the way for foreign intervention that would include even turning Venezuela into a protectorate. Mouths were salivating at the thought of getting their hands on all that Venezuelan oil. Needless to say, that is the point of it all. Venezuela is an extremely rich country in oil, the largest deposit in the hemisphere, in gold and other very rich minerals. So the stage was set that during April, the violence would occur. And the violence that the world media has reported has all been a macabre show put on by the opposition parties to portray Venezuela as a country that's falling apart, whose government is brutal, and those who are setting the fires and throwing the rocks and shooting and terrorizing neighborhoods are not terrorists. They are students. They are freedom fighters. They are heroic citizens standing up for their rights. Not one of them, not one, would have gotten away with such vandalism and crime in the United States, in Canada, in any civilized country. And yet, when the Venezuelan police detains them, they're not described by the media as criminals responsible for all of this, but as political prisoners. Yet the prostituted mainstream media does not want to understand what is going on because it already has had the script given to them. For example, the opposition attacked a maternity hospital in a poor section of town, and 50 mothers and their newborn babies had to be rescued by the community and the police. They have profaned tombs. They've shut highways. They've shot pistols, helter-skelter, set fire to public buildings. To date, there have been 42 deaths, more than 400 injured, and millions of dollars worth of damage. But the media doesn't inform that out of the 335 districts in the country, the violent acts only occur in 19 of them, those 19 that are controlled by opposition mayors. Nor does the media inform that the huge majority of those killed or injured are innocent bystanders and police officers. They never inform that the Venezuelan police and military are not allowed to have live weapons when they are dealing with civilians. In other words, they're unarmed. They carry those sticks, but they don't have guns. It doesn't inform that the rest of the country carried on with its peaceful life. For example, last week there was a lively, highly attended theater festival in the country, all over the country, that brought people from other countries to see it. During Holy Week, 10 million Venezuelans did domestic tourism by going to beaches and mountains for their holidays. If the country were really going to pieces, these events could not possibly happen. None of this was reported in the international media. But what is the real crisis? The real crisis in Venezuela is not about the government, the administration of President Maduro. It is a state crisis. A crisis that has put the very institutions of the state in peril. When the opposition won the majority in the National Assembly January last year, by the way, its president arrived at the National Assembly in the limousine and with the U.S. attaché sitting next to him. There's no ambassador, so he acts as one. Its president declared that they were not there to pass laws, but they were there to get rid of Maduro and his government. This is what the legislative power was going to do. This undemocratic stance then created the crisis that started on the 29th of July, 2016, when the National Assembly, that's the legislative power, declared itself in rebellion against the judicial power, against the sentence of the Supreme Court, that is the highest representative of the judicial power. the Supreme Court declared that three deputies could not be sworn in because of the blatant irregularities in their election. So the National Assembly refused to obey this order, and so the Supreme Court had to declare all its acts null and void. The National Assembly, which has declared itself in rebellion, has proceeded to act as if it were a parallel government. It goes to foreign countries and international banks asking for Venezuela to be sanctioned and blackballed, and even asking the military to overthrow the government. So this is truly a crisis of state. What has been Maduro's response? He has responded by a constant appeal for dialogue with the opposition. Please come to the dialogue table. The Vatican and three ex-presidents of Latin America and one ex-prime minister of Spain have been the facilitators of this dialogue. But in the end, even the Pope had to admit that the dialogue had not been possible because the opposition would not sit at the table. What else could the government do? What could Maduro do? He called the people of Venezuela to democratically amend the constitution so that the crisis of state can be remedied. In fact, he's called for a constitutional assembly to be elected so that it can deal with nine specific topics. This is a huge issue. This constitutional assembly will be elected through public elections. And there are topics that the constitution will be opened on. The topics are those that were not salient or even existent in 1999 when the current constitution was drafted. And no one suspected that it would be so attacked. So some of the topics are how to institutionalize the anti-poverty programs, which are called misiones, which take care of public housing, public school, public health, all of these. The growth of narco traffic and terrorism, we didn't have all of this in 1999. The climate change and what to do about it. The rights of homosexuals and transgender people. And there is no mention, by the way, of prolonging the terms of office of the president. This isn't, as some have said, oh, this is a ploy so that he can be president for life. Those that today, the wealthy oligarchy, the heads of the Venezuelan Catholic Church, the important opposition politicians, and the lawyers who today oppose the dialogue and this constitutional assembly were also the ones that quite openly opposed the constitution of 1999. Now, what do the surveys say? Over half of the Venezuelans surveyed by Monitor País believe that the main people responsible for promoting violent demonstrations should be imprisoned. The polling firm Hinterlassis Monday also indicated that many hold the country's opposition as responsible, with 59% of those polled saying that they trusted the opposition less after the recent violence that has shaken the country. And 65% agreed that the presidential election should be held next year, as the Constitution says, despite the calls from the opposition to hold an early vote. You can't, like in the United States, you can't ask for President Trump to resign and have new elections, because you, the same as in Venezuela, have a term. This is 5 years, 5 years. You can't hold the elections unless the president dies or something like that, right? So most people are quite happy that next year there will be presidential elections. And these polls have 95% accuracy, and they reveal that almost three-quarters of Venezuelans, that's 72%, consider the dialogue between the government and the opposition to be important. So now, what will happen? The government's in a quandary. It calls for dialogue, and it's rejected. The National Assembly continues to be outlawed by its own actions. It has called for the government has called for an election of a National Constitutional Assembly to deal with this crisis of state. And already, the leaders of the opposition have said they will not participate. Only one main opposition party has agreed, the Social Democrats, COPE. Now, it's clear that in the face of this state crisis and of the civil crisis of violence, the fact that the extreme wing of the opposition has taken the upper hand in wanting to continue violent civil disobedience, the government will have to come down with all the force of the law upon them in order to keep order, because order is one of the essential functions of any state. Now, the capitalist world, so afraid and opposed to anything that smacks of socialism, will continue to denigrate and demonize Nicolas Maduro and the Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution. But they have placed the country in a corner, and there's nowhere else to go but to fight back. And after this constitutional amendment go ahead, there will be no quarter for those that conspire against the government, that kill innocent people for their ambitions, or deliberately destabilize the economy. None of this war on the state and the people will be tolerated by any Western democratic country. The good news is that despite the economic problems, and you know, most governments, if there's economic problems, lose at the elections and lose their popularity. Maduro has not lost that core, that essential majority of the people. And so the people know that this is a government that, whatever their faults and faltering along the way, which every government has, because no government is perfect, at least that government is on their side. And the other thing that Venezuela has going for it, it has solid solidarity from so many of the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean. The Caribbean countries, except for three of them, withstood tremendous pressure from the United States at the OAS that had threatened them, threatened even a small country like Haiti, had threatened them economically if they voted for Venezuela. And these small Caribbean countries, with such dignity, voted on principle to support Venezuela. And I think that Venezuela finally gave up on the OAS and said, we're leaving. This Organization of American States is just trying to oppress Venezuela, and we're not going to be part of it. So this act was greeted with joy in Venezuela, with joy. People on the streets, very happy that Venezuela is no longer in the OAS, because it was obviously a conspiracy to overthrow the government of President Maduro. Now, according to the Constitution, there have to be elections for municipalities this year, and the government said they would do them. They're going to have two elections now, one for the assembly, one for the municipalities. But the presidential elections have to be next year, in 2018. And neither the president nor the electoral power, the electoral organization, has said that there won't be. So there will be elections next year for president. But it will be very interesting to see what this assembly is going to do, how it's going to amend the Constitution. Actually, it's not actually amending it, but adding to it, because these nine areas were not covered in the first Constitution. Now, I want to also say one thing. The Venezuelan Constitution is not like the American one or the Canadian one or that of many countries that was done, 200 years ago and is, considered sort of, untouchable. The Venezuelan Constitution is much more of that malleable, and it's a constitution that the people know. If you walk down the streets of Venezuela and you stop five people, you'll see three of them will have a copy of the Constitution in their pockets, because it was a constitution that was written in 1999 in ordinary Spanish, not in legalese. So it's easy to read. Anyone can read this constitution without getting their mind mixed up, on legal phrases. So it's highly loved, and it's been the cornerstone of the Bolivarian Revolution. But now people see, look, we're confronting a sort of a war that we never imagined and the government feels that it can't, doesn't have the tools with which to confront it. So we will see what will happen, and we live in interesting times.
I have two more questions for you.
Yes.
For years, U.S. foreign policy has pushed the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and to back creditor interests and foreign investment in the privatization in Latin American countries. At the same time, it has forced these institutions to isolate countries such as Cuba and Venezuela, and more recently Ecuador, to prove the point that neoliberal diplomacy will turn these nations into pariahs and heretics and rogues, and refer to them as dictatorships if they oppose economic austerity and financialization. And Venezuela has a long time been a victim of this American foreign policy. Now, we have not been supporters of Hillary Clinton or the Democrats, nor the Republicans on this program. And I know that Hillary Clinton and Obama had their sights on removing Chavez and later Maduro when in the White House. So speak about that. And then you witnessed the efforts for regime change are stronger, more aggressive since Trump took office. And in what ways? So please address Obama, a Clinton, and then Trump. You have about 6 minutes before the program's over.
Well, Obama was a huge disappointment because when he was elected, people in Venezuela were writing and happy, oh, this man, you know, he knows what it is. He's been a black person. He must know about oppression. He's going to change. Well, of course, it didn't happen. With Hillary Clinton, she very quickly burned her bridges, her acting when she went to Colombia, her acting in Ukraine, the fact that she openly and boasted about the coup in Honduras. All of this thing made people really detest her, actually, in Latin America. So what we have seen is, and history, I think, really backs me up on this. There are many differences in domestic policies in presidential elections in the United States, but there's very little difference between Republican and Democratic foreign policy toward Latin America. It's the same thing. Latin America is the backyard, and the Monroe Doctrine is what we're going to enforce, and they better do what we say. That's basically it. I mean, it's very crude what I'm saying, but every single reformer, every power or government or person that has ever had power in Latin America wanting to change the status quo has been deposed or killed by elements backed by the United States. And the United States has backed every single dictator in Latin America. And for those of you who may not believe me, I ask you to just go on Google and write down Operation Condor, and you will see that 60,000 Latin Americans, 60,000 reformers, teachers, syndicalists, socialists were killed, were taken from one country to the other. It was the biggest sort of massacre, really, since, I think, Spain. So people don't know what to think. And now, with the President Trump, we can only hope that he doesn't think that he can have an easy win by trying to invade Venezuela. And by the way, the idea of invading Venezuela is there in the Southern Command. The Southern Command now has a second person there who is running the show, who is an expert on these, destabilizing and coup making.
Regime change.
And this is really terrible. It has thrown red lights everywhere. So the government of Venezuela, who is already under an edict of Obama, who ridiculously called Venezuela a threat to American secure. I can't even say it. I can't even imagine how Venezuela could possibly be a threat to the security of the United States. I mean, it's like an elephant saying that a little ant there is going to bite them and kill them, okay? So with Trump, I hope that that more level-headed minds are in there somewhere in his department
they're not.
Will tell him,
Maria,
that any invasion of Venezuela will be...
Maria, unfortunately, we're out of time for this segment, but I want to thank you very much for coming on. Can you give us a website to get more information that you and others have prepared to tell the truth about Venezuelanist politics?
Well, I will really recommend that you go to Telesur in English. Telesur has a section in English called www.telesur.net English and VenezuelaAnalysis.com, VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And, of course, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CPR.net. These are three very good websites that are very rational and try to really be good journalism about what is going on in Venezuela.
Maria,
and before I go, let me just thank you from the bottom of my heart, because this message is just... we cannot give this message in the ordinary media, because they don't want to listen to it.
Well, we're not the ordinary media, and you're not the ordinary reporter on an issue. So we appreciate you being here with us. We appreciate your cause for truth, and we will invite you back to continue your story. Dr. Maria Paez Victor, she is a professor, and she's a major advocate for the truth in the media concerning Venezuela. Thank you for being with us.
There's a bridge and there's a river that I still must cross as I'm going on my journey. Though I might be lost, and there's a road I have to follow, a place I have to go. Well, no one told me just how to get there, but when I get there, I know, 'cause I'm taking it step by step.
I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The topic is Islamophobic administration, the rise of a nationalist ideology behind government policies. My guest is Faiza Patel. She is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center at New York University's Law School, where she is a specializing member on the growing Islamophobia and regressive surveillance of Muslims by the United States government. She has testified before Congress and organized advocacy efforts against state laws that incite fear of Islam. She's a frequent commentator on national security and counterterrorism issues, and she is also a senior policy official for the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in The Hague, and served as a law clerk at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. She was born and raised in Pakistan. She is a graduate of Harvard and received her law degree from New York University's Law School. She's a lead author of the recent Brennan Report, The Islamophobic Administration and the Trump Administration's Role in Increasing and Inciting a National Hatred Towards Muslims. The report can be found at Brennan, that's Brennan, center.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be with you.
One of the many dramatic changes we have witnessed in the Trump White House is the extreme departure from earlier administrations, including George Bush, regarding defining and identifying terrorism. And the previous four presidents were very clear to distinguish the rise of the Salafi militancy and violence from the fundamental principles of Islam that the vast majority of the world's Muslim embrace. And even Bush stated that, quote, the war against terrorism is not a war against Muslims, nor is it a war against Arabs. Indeed, Saudi Arabia, the largest sponsor of terrorist groups, in my opinion, continues to remain Washington's closest allies in the Arab world. Now we have a president who makes no distinction between terrorist violence and the fundamental principles of Islam in general. In fact, I would argue that many of Trump's approved cabinet appointees represent a Christian Taliban that is also found in Christian fundamentalist extremism, which we'll get to a little later. But before we go into the Islamophobia that rules over Trump's White House, I would like you to begin by sharing a little bit of the American Muslim communities in general. How large is it? What has been its participation and role in American civil society and social issues? And what do you believe have been Muslims' greatest contributions to the vast majority of Americans that we're not aware of? Or people are simply intentionally ignorant or simply don't want to know the truth. And I observe largely ignored by the majority of the mainstream media. And even a lot of the alternative media are ignoring the positive aspects of what Islamic culture has given us throughout the centuries. And though they are very good at detailing some of the Islamic extreme individuals and groups, the forum is yours. Take your time, please.
Thank you, Gary. Well, I think one thing that's important to point out is that there's a general perception that the United States has a very large Muslim population because Muslims get so much attention in the press. In fact, the population of the United States is very small. It's estimated to be about a little bit over 3 million people across the entire country, so less than 1% of the population of the United States. And the reason this is an estimate is because the census does not ask any questions about people's faith. So these are projections that are based on research that various folks, including the Pew Research Center, has done. The population is very, very diverse. So about a third of American Muslims are African American. Some of these folks came over here as slaves. It's estimated that about between 10 and 30% of the slaves that were brought to the United States from the African continent were Muslim, although their religion was very severely repressed when they came to the United States. The other two-thirds of American Muslims are of an immigrant background, so they're either first or second generation immigrants to the United States, and that population, the immigrant population, comes from all over the Muslim world. So you have people from South Asia, you have people from the Arab world, you have people from Africa, Indonesia, you name it. So it's a very, very diverse population, and one that speaks many languages, is ethnically diverse, follows various different strands of the Islamic faith, and is also dispersed geographically across the United States. So there are a few cities and states where you'll see large populations of Muslims. So New York City, obviously, as a great immigrant city, has between 600,000 to 800,000 Muslims. New Jersey also has a big population. You also see some population centers, for example, in Dearborn, Michigan, where there's a large Arab population, a big part of which is also Muslim, which came over when the auto industry recruited them to come work over there. In Minneapolis, you have a large population of Somalis. So you have these pockets across the country, but basically they're kind of spread out across the entire United States. You asked about, well, what are the sort of contributions that American Muslims have made? And I think that I like to think about American Muslims as being just regular Americans. So they've made the same kinds of contributions that everybody else does. You have police officers who are Muslim. You've had people serving in the military who are Muslim. You have doctors, lawyers, taxi drivers, food cart vendors. I think that Muslims are integrated into pretty much every part of our society. There's definitely been, a spotlight put on Muslims since the attacks of 9/11, with ever greater curiosity amongst the press about, who are these Muslims living over here? And you do see, many stories about Muslims participating, for example, in the Olympics. We had the fencer who wore her headscarf while she competed in the Olympics. So you have a few prominent folks there. You've had some in the entertainment industry. You know, Hasan Minhaj recently from The Daily Show hosted the White House Correspondents Association dinner. So you have many comedians coming out. So you have this range of different people. You also talked about, you know, what about Islamic culture more broadly, and I think that's a really great question as well, because of course, you know, Islam is the religion of 1.6 billion people around the world. You know, some of the oldest civilizations are located in countries that are Islamic now, and has contributed greatly to the development of many things that we don't think about. But for example, algebra was preserved by Arabs. You know, you have a very rich cultural history and musical history. A few years ago, the Brooklyn Academy of Music had this week-long festival called Muslim Voices. And it was truly remarkable because it really highlighted sort of the great variety of contributions in music and the arts that have been made by Muslim countries. So I think you're right. We often really only see images of Muslims as terrorists in the papers, but there's a broad and rich array of contributions there.
I appreciate the overview. Thank you. Would you also please give us your overview of Trump's views about Islam, and how does it fundamentally depart from the previous presidents, and how has he incited hatred towards Muslims and turned this into a strategic goal to bring himself to office? And finally, in your estimation, what has been the consequences of his campaign's Islamophobia for the American Muslim population thus far?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's sort of, you know, two issues here. One is what an administration says, and one is what they do. Now, as you pointed out, you know, the previous presidents have been very, very careful to distinguish between Islam as a faith, which, you know, obviously has 1.6 billion adherents across the world, versus the folks who do commit violence in the name of Islam. And Trump has really refused to make that distinction and has said things such as, you know, that Islam hates us, and he has sort of, he was once questioned about, you know, well, you know, does Islam itself hate us? I mean, that, is there something fundamentally wrong with the religion? And he kind of refused to answer that question. Whereas, obviously, you know, George Bush and President Obama were both quite careful to distinguish between sort of the vast majority of peaceful Muslims and really went out of their way to make that distinction. And this whole kind of debate is encapsulated in this phrase, radical Islamic terrorism, which, as you know, was a point of contention where Trump was very insistent that he would, you needed to name the enemy in order to fight the enemy. And the enemy, he said, was radical Islamic terrorism. Now, Obama had a very functional reason for not wanting to use that phrase, because he didn't want to alienate the vast majority of Muslims who are as against violence as the next person, right? Whereas for Trump, this had a very important symbolic meaning, and he really wanted to and does use that phrase whenever he can. I think, though, when you, and we can talk about the impact of you know, rhetoric coming from people in power and what kind of sort of effects that has on individuals. But I think an important thing to remember also is that we should look not just at words, but also at actions, right? And, you know, Trump here has been very explicit in his targeting of Muslims. You know, he's called for a ban on Muslims entering the country, and he did that consistently throughout his campaign, and even went so far as to issue an executive order that would ban people from initially seven and now six Muslim countries from coming into the United States, and also halt refugee admissions. These bans have been rejected by the court. They have enjoined their implementation because of they find that the intent behind these bans is not the stated security rationale, but actually to ban people of a certain faith from coming to the United States. On the other hand, I think that, you know, one also has to look at the policies that were undertaken, you know, initially by President Bush, but many of which were carried on by President Obama. And there I think you find less of a break and more of a continuity in terms of the actions. So one of the things that happened, you know, after the 9/11 attacks is that there has been a great deal of suspicion cast on the American Muslim community, and this has manifested itself not only in the broader culture, but in terms of specific law enforcement tactics that were being used by the FBI, by the New York City Police Department, which basically, you know, treat these communities as being pools of suspects and therefore infiltrate them and subject them to extensive surveillance. And these things started during the Bush era and were continued under the Obama era. The other thing that's been going on is, you know, we talk about these travel bans, and the reality is that, you know, if you were coming to the United States from a country like Yemen or Syria, you know, you were always going to have a great deal of vetting done before you were issued a visa. You know, there have been a lot of stories about, you know, religious questioning at the border, and that seems to have jumped dramatically in the first 3 months of this administration. But religious questioning at the border was something that we heard about all through the Obama years, right? It's an extreme version. It's an amped up version of what was going on in the previous administration. But in some sense, it's not exactly all that new. Now, the other piece of this story that's worth thinking about is sort of, well, what does it mean when the President of the United States makes these kinds of statements about, you know, people who are Americans, right? You know, sort of, I wouldn't go as far as saying inciting hatred, but certainly making these very negative remarks that sort of tar an entire community with the terrorist brush, and also for bringing into his inner circle people who are known for having, you know, extraordinarily bigoted views towards people of the Muslim faith. And I think what we've certainly seen is that there has been a reported rise in crimes against Muslims and people who people assume are Muslim, even if they're not. So, you know, we've seen some prominent examples of you know, people of South Asian descent being attacked because they were assumed to be Muslim, or Iranians who are non-Muslim Iranians. So, and we've definitely seen this. We don't have official numbers yet. So the FBI issues these annual reports on the number of hate crimes, which breaks them down by category. And the last report, which was issued, I think, in November of 2016, would have covered statistics from 2015. And we definitely saw a jump in hate crimes against Muslims in that report. But we have had a number of organizations, including ProPublica and the New York Times, as well as various non-governmental organizations that are tracking these kinds of incidents, and they all report having seen, you know, fairly dramatic increases in hate crimes. But again, here I kind of want to issue a note of caution, which is that, you know, hate crimes against Muslims spiked in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and then they kind of leveled off. But starting in 2010, we've seen a steadily increasing rise in these kind of hate crimes, which is attributed in part to, well, at least I think it's in part because there is a very organized movement of anti-Muslim groups and individuals who have been really working hard to stir up fear of Muslims, many times at the state level, but also in sort of more high publicity events nationally. And one of the things that I find very disturbing is some of the folks who are part of Trump's inner circle not only make these kinds of statements themselves, but are actually fairly tightly tied into some of these groups that have been out there over the last several years, really working hard to whip up hatred.
Very definitive. Thank you. Hate crimes increased dramatically during Trump's campaign. You mentioned they started after 9/11, then restarted again in 2010, and they're continuing to rise. Connect the dots between the growing violence and Trump's rhetoric, and can he be legally held responsible for this rise in racial and crimes of faith?
You know, I don't think he's likely to be held legally responsible. And as a lawyer, I'm always reluctant to attribute causation rather than note correlation. So I think what we see here is that, there's no question that he has made it sort of almost a signature of his campaign, right? This anti-Muslim rhetoric and kind of suggesting that kind of playing the tough guy with Muslims is going to keep us more secure. And we know that during 2015, which was the year his campaign season kicked off, hate crimes against Muslims soared about 67%, the highest level since 9/11. And 2016, we expect, is going to show that it was the worst year on record in terms of these kind of bias incidents towards Muslims. And certainly we see that some of the folks who engage in this kind of violence do invoke the president, right, as being their inspiration. So in March, for example, you know, there was a note left at an Islamic center in Iowa which threatened that, like, the new sheriff in town, Donald Trump, was going to cleanse America and was going to start with all the Muslims. And this is not an isolated incident. Like, these kinds of notes have been received by other mosques itself. We see these kind of verbal references to the kinds of things that Trump has been saying. And so, you know, there's definitely an effect, right? I mean, there's some impact in the sense that, you know, people are at least feeling freer to voice these kinds of sentiments and take these kinds of actions against fellow Americans. And that's really, really disturbing. And frankly, it's really irresponsible of somebody in a position of power to be denigrating or casting suspicion on one part of the American population.
Not everything that Trump and his cabinet have attempted to implement has been implemented, and some of their crimes, or I shouldn't say some of their crimes, some of their original proposals, in my opinion, were textbook examples used in Nazi Germany, especially in the 1930s. Could you describe some of these, and based upon whatever databases or internment camps or situations that you have encountered in your research, and are the constitutional statutes in place that prevented them from going forward?
Well, I mean, I think the big thing that Trump has tried to do was the Muslim ban, right? So just about, I think, exactly a week after he took office on January 27th, he issued an executive order that banned travel from 7 Muslim countries and also suspended the refugee program and stopped all Syrian refugees on a permanent basis. And a couple of the things that were really remarkable about this order were that it actually included in it an explicit religious preference for Muslims. So basically it said, you know, we're not letting in people from these 7 Muslim countries except for religious minorities. So any non-Muslim from Syria would be given a preference, whereas Muslims from Syria would be banned from coming into the country. The other kind of remarkable thing about the order, which was that it applied to legal permanent residents, right? So there are people who, you know, come to the United States, maybe they study here, they start working here, or they marry an American, and they have what's called a green card. They're legal permanent residents, they live here, but they don't have U.S. nationality. They'll pay taxes here, they won't vote, But these are generally, a lot of times these are people who have lived here for many, many years, right? And they are, you know, they're not the same as a tourist from China coming to visit, you know, and look at the Empire State Building. So they're people with close ties and contacts and communities here in the United States. And the Trump administration deliberately took the decision to extend this order to legal permanent residents, which was, I think, quite an extraordinary act of overreach on their part. So you had this order, you know, I'm sure you know the chaos that ensued because it was issued on I believe, late on that Friday, the 27th, in the meantime, with immediate effect. So you had people who, you know, were on planes already coming to the United States who were from these countries. There were people who had been living here as permanent residents for years who were coming back from a family vacation or a business trip, and you know, they land in the United States and they're told that, you know, they can't enter the country where they live. And you had these extraordinary scenes also of refugees who had been given refugee status, had refugee visas, you know, flew to the United States, you know, older people, children stranded at airports. And you had the same scene kind of unfolding at airports around the world where people were trying to get on flights to come to the United States and were prevented from doing so. I mean, this was really just a complete debacle. And very shortly after, I believe the order issued Friday, by Sunday or Monday, I'm not quite sure, there was an injunction issued against implementation of the order. So in essence, you know, lawyers went into the court and said, look, you know, this order is unconstitutional, we're going to challenge it, and it's causing so much damage that you court should stop its implementation while we consider the merit stage of the case. And that was sort of the first wave of the Muslim ban. You know, after that, you know, the same case was, there were, I think there were about 50 cases filed across the country. But the same case was being heard by several different courts. And the first trial court decision that went up to the appeals court was out west in the Ninth Circuit, which heard arguments on this and upheld the injunction so that the implementation of that January 27th order was halted. So then there was this sort of, you know, period of some confusion where it wasn't really clear what the administration was going to do. Were they going to appeal this? How were they going to do it? Which case were they going to do it in? But instead, what they did was on March 6th, they issued a new order and sought to ameliorate some of the obvious defects of the first order. So one of the things they did was they took out the preference for religious minorities. They made it clear that it wouldn't apply to legal permanent residents. And they also did this interesting thing, which is they added in this whole couple of pages national security justification for the order. And the reason they did that is because in the first go-around, you had something like 130 national security experts from different administrations who filed an affidavit saying, look, you know, this kind of stuff is actually detrimental to our national security. You know, we were saying that we should ban people from Iraq, and we're out there basically fighting with Iraqi forces against ISIS. So how is it helping our overall national security goals to be doing this? You also had, you know, leaks of DHS reports coming out which said, you know, that nationality was not a good proxy for terrorism. So you had a lot of pushback from the national security establishment as to the wisdom of this just from a purely security point of view. So the March 6th order had this sort of relatively extensive national security justification, which was meant to rebut that. And the other thing that the second version of the order did was that they dropped Iraq from the list of countries from which people were banned. So now you fast forward a little bit further. This second version of the order was also challenged in court, and it was also stopped by two courts, one in Maryland and another one in Hawaii. And these cases are now now making their way up through the appellate layers of our system, presumably on their way to the Supreme Court. And just yesterday, the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit heard the appeal from the Maryland case. They haven't decided it yet. It was just oral arguments yesterday. And the Ninth Circuit sitting out west will be hearing oral arguments on the 15th. And, you know, one of the sort of really interesting things about these cases is that a lot of the discussion is about the intent behind the order and how far judges can go in looking at the statements that Trump and his surrogates have made about what they were trying to do with this ban. Because if courts can look beyond the four corners of the ban to the actual intent, the statement of which there's loads of evidence, then it becomes a fairly easy case. If courts confine themselves to just looking at the words on the piece of paper, the case becomes a little more challenging legally.
Well, I certainly appreciate the Islamophobia Administration report. The website is brenancenter.org. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.